Welcome everybody to the Blue Skies Dronecast, the podcast by UAV Hub. This is a podcast for the UK drone industry, discussing everything from the UK regulations, new drones, and also speaking to you, the people within the drone industry. Presented this week, as always, by Tom and Adam. So welcome along, everybody. Another episode here for you this week. And we've got a couple of subjects we're going to be talking about over the next sort of 30 minutes or so. So the first one is going to be talking about white labelling. So we've had quite an interesting question, and that's come in from Tony Doyle. And you might recognise his name because he was actually on our podcast probably longer ago than I'm going to probably say. But yeah, he was definitely in an episode for roof surveying. So we're going to be answering some of his questions. And also then to finish off the episode, we can't really not mention the DJI Mini 3. So we're going to have a bit of a rumour roundup to see what happens there. So that's basically how we're going to go. We've got Adam with us as well, so he'll be helping me out and taking the lead on some of the questions too. So without further ado, I think what we'll do is we'll roll straight into the first subject then. So obviously I mentioned white labelling. Before we go into the questions from Tony, for those of you who maybe aren't aware of the phrase white labelling, I guess we better kind of explain that and what it means. So what I'll do is I'll hand over my faithful sidekick, Adam, and he can talk us through white labelling. So Adam, what's that all about?
Cheers, Tom. So white labelling, it's surprisingly used, I suppose, quite a lot within the industry, and not a lot of people are aware of it. So effectively, white labelling is when you... So let's say I am a remote pilot. I have my own permissions. I do a job for somebody else, but my company doesn't get the credit. I don't turn up with my, you know, high-vis vest on with my company on. I am flying for this other company as if I work for that company.
Okay.
So there's none of my branding, there's none of my kind of showing off, you know, look what I can do. It's actually, you are all in for this other company.
Okay.
But you aren't employed by the other company. That's the difference here. You're not employed by them. You're still subcontracted by this other company. But
okay.
You are operating as if you are this company.
I see. So a bit like a rent-a-pilot or something, I suppose, isn't it? It's something similar to that, I suppose. The company, let's say, has been double-booked or something like that, and I suppose they can take care of one of the jobs, but they need someone else to do the other job, hence why you might be white labelled in to work, in inverted commas, for the company, obviously not getting credit personally, I suppose. That's basically it, isn't it? I see.
Yeah, that's it. So if I am the client that's got my own client, so they've hired my company, and I can't do it for whatever reason. You know, I've broken my foot. But I don't want to tell the client I can't do this job. I don't want to let the client down. So I hire somebody else in and say, look, you do the work as if you're me, as if you're my company, but don't tell the client. You know, just treat them as if you're a part of my company. You're one of my employees.
Yeah.
You do the work.
I see.
But I'll still pay you. You know, obviously, I'll still pay you. You just don't get the credit at the end of it. I do.
Yeah, I see. That makes sense. And I guess you might also do that type of thing. Let's say you get a job in which requires special permissions, or you need to fly closer to something or higher than the maximum limit. And obviously you yourself can't do that, but you might know someone who might have an OSC, I suppose, and has better permissions. And that might be a good idea to actually get them in. Still looks like you're doing the job, so it looks like you've sort of, you know, done your bit and catered to what the client needs, but you've got someone else who's got the better permission, so you could use it then, couldn't you, Adam, I suppose, too?
Yeah, that's it. So it's a great way for if you want to show off that you can do better things. You could advertise, I can get down to 10 metres from uninvolved people with my Inspire 2. Actually, you can't, but I know somebody that does, and I'll hire them in to do the work for me. And that we've got a few kind of, I think there's a few questions coming up from Tony, which I kind of will, I think some people are going, but what if this happens, which we will answer shortly. So there are a few kind of caveats to it in regards to operations manuals and all that lovely stuff.
Yes.
Which we'll get into shortly.
I see. Yeah, that's it. So the pilot will get essentially a fee to do that that single job. So it might not be the full fee that they normally ask for, because obviously they haven't had to find the work, so they've kind of been hired in. So there's sometimes a finder's fee, I suppose, that might come into it as well. But that'll obviously be agreed between the company who's accepted the job and then obviously the white labelled pilot, I suppose, as well. So that's how it'll work. So I think that's explained what white labelling is, Adam. I think we can move on to Tony's questions, do you think?
I think so, yeah. So it's kind of, you are still subcontracting out the work, but the client is not aware that you've subcontracted the work. I think that's the key thing. It's your client who's paying you to do the job isn't aware that actually you're going to pay somebody else. And I think another kind of way of looking at it is a bit like, let's say you go to a large company, let's say, I don't know, for example, I don't know, British Gas, let's say. I'm not saying they do this, but let's say for argument's sake, you go to British Gas and they service your boiler, and they say, oh yeah, we will send out an engineer, and they'll turn up under British Gas engineer. Now actually, that British Gas engineer might not actually work for British Gas. You know, they might have their own limited company, their own sole trader company.
I see, yeah.
But they are working under a one-off fee for British Gas just to do this one particular job, but you wouldn't know.
I see. Yeah, that totally makes sense. Yeah, and it's all to do with basically making sure that you can say yes to the client. It doesn't matter how you do it, as long as you look as though you can sort of take on their work, I suppose. And if you trust the pilot that you're getting in, then obviously that's probably a big thing, actually, making sure that you don't just hire any old person in. You want to be able to trust them because they're essentially going to have your branding on them, and if they make a bit of a mess of it, then it makes your company look bad. So actually sometimes it's a bit of a minefield, actually, isn't it? So yeah, that's something to bear in mind too.
And we've done it ourselves, you know, as a company. We've white labeled for other people and had other pilots white label for us, because a few years ago we had quite hefty jobs going up and down the country doing wind turbines.
That's right, yeah, I remember that.
At the time, and because, you know, we're only a relatively small company, we didn't have all the pilots to facilitate this and training and everything, so actually we hired pilots in to white label as if they were our pilots. The client didn't know that.
No.
That they weren't potentially on our... they weren't employees of ours.
Yeah.
But they were still our pilots. They operated for us.
Yeah, and we knew them, and we knew they were good, so it was actually brilliant and worked really well. We couldn't have done it actually without the other pilots. I think I would have probably died. So yeah. Anyway, what we'll do is let's move on to the questions then from Tony. So he's got a couple here about white labeling. So if we start off with the first one, so if I do white label work for a client who presents the data as their own, does that client also need to have drone-specific insurance as per the CAA requirement? So what do you reckon to that, Adam?
A couple of caveats to this. So if the company doesn't have an operational authorization and they've hired you in, but they've said to the client, oh yeah, we've got pilots, but actually they've got nobody that can do the job, and you're operating under your operational authorization, you'll be operating under your insurance. Now, the client, so whoever's paying you, doesn't need the drone insurance, you know, the commercial drone insurance, as it were. They don't need that, but you, as the pilot and the UAS operator, need the insurance. Now, if you're operating under their operational authorization, so they've hired you in, but they've said, actually, we're going to have you operate under our permissions, and we'll add you into our operations manual, then the company that's hired you then needs the insurance, because they have the operational authorization anyway, so they should have insurance in place. So that's the key thing. So if you're operating under your permissions, you need the insurance, the appropriate insurance for your flight. If you're operating under their permissions or their authorization, then they need the insurance. You technically don't need the insurance for that flight because you're operating under their insurance.
So I guess the first thing is to make sure you know which way you're going with that side of things. Are you using your permission, or are you under their permission, I think is the sort of the headline there, isn't it?
that's it. And it's kind of this, you know, if you're operating under your permissions, that's where actually your white labeling are put into inverted commas, because you're operating under your, it's your company doing the work.
Yes.
But you're looking as though you're this other company. Where actually, if you're operating under their permissions, under their operational authorization, then actually it wouldn't be a white labeling, because you're just a subcontracted pilot going into their operations manual. Like, you're operating under their manual. It's their job.
Yeah, that's true. You're an employee, effectively, then, aren't you? Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I see. Yeah, brilliant. Okay, cool. Well, hopefully that's answered question number one. Let's move on to the next one then. So for white label work, whose ops manual applies, mine or the client's? And I guess that's kind of similar again, isn't it? So it all depends on which way you go, Adam, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's it. So we've kind of already answered this a little bit. So if, for argument's sake, that both companies have an operations manual and an operational authorization, at the point of sort of, you know, you being employed to do the work, whether it's white label or not, you need to find out, okay, am I operating under my permissions or am I operating under yours? In which case, if you're operating under the client's permissions or authorization, then you need to make sure that you are wrote into their operations manual before you do the flight. Otherwise, you're flying illegally.
Yeah.
So you need to make sure that you know whose authorization you're flying under.
Mm-hmm.
That will dictate whose ops manual applies. And again, if you are flying under a client's operational authorization, you need to follow their procedures. If they've got different procedures in their ops manual to yours, you need to understand their ops manual and understand their procedures, because it might be different to what you're used to.
Yeah, I see.
So I suppose a little bit different, obviously, if you're doing this as an OSC job, you know, and it's your OSC, obviously you will be operating under your operating safety case, under your permissions, your authorization, because you are the one being hired in to do that. The client doesn't have that. There's no point you being wrote into their ops manual, because they don't have the special permissions.
No.
You do. So it's your ops manual, your three-volume OSC you're operating under.
Yeah, that's it. So let's pretend, you know, I'm sort of a bystander and I just listen to this conversation. It kind of makes sense to actually not be in their ops manual and literally follow your ops manual and your OA, because you know exactly how that all works. I think it sounds a bit messy if you suddenly then have to essentially sit down and read another company's ops manual, understand their processes. It might all be really different and there's room for errors and problems, isn't there? So I think, yeah, it makes sense if you're going to white label for someone, you're basically just working as if you were doing the job yourself, but you just need to not wear your branded coat or something instead and be nice and friendly, or more so maybe than you are before, I suppose, as well. And that kind of, I think, leads us into sort of the last question. It's again, quite a similar thing, really. It's all to do with the ops manual side of things. So again, I think we've answered that really before. Obviously, depending on whether you're white labelling or whether you're going to be employed by the company, that's the ops manual that you need to be aware of. And as we've just mentioned, it's easier to do white labelling and just keep everything as you're used to, because then there's less chance for, you know, sort of messing things up, because obviously the way you do things is the same, which is, you know, the best way to work, I think. That's pretty much that one answered too, I think, Adam, isn't it?
That's pretty much it. The only thing I'm just going to add in is about the sort of where the operator ID fits into all of this, because I think that some people could get potentially caught out with this. So if you're operating under your permissions, under your authorization, and it's your obviously it's your aircraft or hired an aircraft, you need to make sure that you've got your operator ID on the aircraft, because that is linked to your authorization, your operational authorization. But if you're operating under a client's operational authorization, but it's your aircraft, you need to make sure that your aircraft is in their ops manual. So, you know, if it's a Mavic 2 Pro and it wasn't in their ops manual originally, make sure it's added in. But secondly, you then need to add on your operator ID from the ops manual, because you're now ultimately responsible under that OA rather than your own. Because obviously, if the aircraft falls out of the sky for whatever reason, you know, when it was picked up by somebody, yes, it will get linked back to you, but the person ultimately responsible for that job was the client, because you're operating under their permissions. Yes. Now, so this is a bit different, I suppose, for, you know, if you're operating under an A2C of CO, the ops manual doesn't count. So a little bit different for that. We're primarily talking here about those that have a GVC and an operational authorization.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But with that side of things, yeah, the operator ID is actually quite important because it's the person who, or the company that's in charge of the aircraft for that particular flight. And if you've just done one odd flight for that other company there for that flight, yeah, they need to be held accountable, don't they? So it makes sense. So yeah, there must be maybe there's a nice way of being able to have some sort of magnetic thing so you could just click on your operator ID and then click it off and put someone else's on, you know, I don't know. But yeah, as long as that is something that you haven't forgotten, then I think that's probably the only sort of caveat to all of this. But other than that, I think
that's what I would do. And I would put on the operator ID of the client if I'm operating under their ops manual.
Yes.
I think that just makes things a little bit more straightforward because it's their accountable manager who is ultimately responsible for the job.
Yeah.
But if it's your aircraft and your operational authorization, it's your operator ID that stays on the aircraft.
Yeah. So it sounds, again, like we just already mentioned, it sounds easier to keep everything kind of separate and just do it as a white label service, I think is probably the final conclusion, I guess, really, isn't it, for this?
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah. Nice. Cool. Okay. Well, anyway, hopefully that was useful, Tony. So lastly, then, we're just going to chat about the hottest new aircraft. And I think it probably will be, depending on the weight. That's probably the main thing for most people. The Midi 3. So you probably know this aircraft. Well, we don't know it exists 100%, but again, we're pretty certain. I think it's going to exist.
Do.
Yeah, we. Okay, let's say we do.
We know it's coming.
We've seen the pictures, and I think that was over the Easter weekend, wasn't it? Some pictures found their way onto our Facebook group, and I was quite impressed with it. Actually, it looks a lot more like it means business than the Mini 2. The Mini 2 was very much the Mavic Mini, really, wasn't it? Whereas this thing looks like it's been totally redesigned, and I reckon they've obviously looked at the sales figures for the Mavic Mini and the Mini 2 and thought, okay, this might be our new area to really focus on because it's so popular, and it looks like they've really put a lot of work into it. So if you can have a quick Google search for the Mini 3, you'll come up with a Tech Radar website and other ones as well, and all the pictures are listed there, and all the information that we're basically going to go through is there too. And so really important drone, I think, and no idea when it's going to be coming out yet, I don't think, Adam, is there? There's no kind of they kind of get announced kind of out of the blue normally, so a couple of months, I mean,
I was going to say there's enough information, I would say, out there now and enough leaks to say it's a couple of months, I would say.
Looks pretty ready, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would say the fact that we've got the aircraft and all the kind of the promotional shots are leaking, we're weeks, if not months away.
Yeah, I'd agree too, yeah. So let's just go through a few of the specs then before we kind of wrap up the episode. So first of all, it's going to have a lot more obstacle avoidance, I think, which is really good. So they reckon tri-directional objects avoidance. So looking at the pictures, it's definitely going to have front-facing obstacle avoidance, which is obviously great, and potentially either the back and the sides, or maybe the bottom and the back, or something similar. So it's going to have a lot more, it's going to be aware of its surroundings a lot more, which I think straight away for people who are just beginning is really good, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's what's needed on these small aircraft, because I don't think, does the Mini 2 not have obstacle avoidance?
It either has it on the front or it doesn't have it at all. Yeah, I probably should know that, but I can't remember.
It's one of those that's just completely got, I don't think it has got it on the front, because I think on the new ones it's got those kind of two beady eyes, as it were, for the front obstacle avoidance. I don't think the Mini 2 has.
No, I don't think it does, actually, thinking back. No, so that'll be a great kind of starting point, I think, for most people anyway, I think, for that side of things. So, yeah, especially on the front, the back, you know, maybe the top, because, again, a lot of people go up when they probably shouldn't do and stuff like that, so that would be helpful. So that's the first thing, I think, and that's great that they've been able to kind of squeeze that onto the aircraft, because obviously it's another at least 4-6 cameras or so that's pretty cool. And then along with that, obviously, because now it's got the obstacle avoidance, it can use active track. It did have a very sort of low quality version of sort of tracking, I think, on the older one, but this one obviously now is going to be fully automated, purely because of the extra cameras. So active track 4.0 as well, which is good to see. Then there's a bit more about the camera side of things, Adam, so do you want to talk us through that?
Yeah, so the sensitizer has been upped, or hopefully will be upped, to one over 1.3 inch, which is always a weird one to say, CMOS sensor, but yes, a bit bigger than the Mini 2, which is always appreciated. It always surprised me, actually, how far they're going to be able to push these sensor sizes, because they're limited by the physical size, and obviously the bigger the sensor size, the bigger the payload is.
Yeah.
So I think they're squeezing every last, well, I'd say inch, but, you know, tiny millimeter,
yes,
they can out of them. HDR, apparently, which is nice. Dual native ISO, again, quite nice. 4K 60p video mode. So, again, pretty good. I'd almost argue, like, what's the point of the Air 2S?
Yeah.
Slightly bigger sensor size than the S, but they're really kind of weirdly internally gunning for their own next-level aircraft with this.
Yeah, that's it. Especially with the, you know, the differences in distances and permissions, it that would almost lead me to choose the Mini 3. I think it probably would, to be honest. Yeah, that's it. And up from 30 frames a second, I think it was on the Mini 2, to 60. That's obviously a nice bump, isn't it, as well, which is cool too. And 48 megapixels, do we think, as well, potentially?
I would say so. They're always squeezing as many megapixels as they can out of these out of these cameras now. So I would expect about 48 these days.
Yeah, which is good as well. And looking at the pictures once again, it looks like they've really gone for a sort of a squeezed down Mavic type gimbal as well. Because obviously the Mini 2 had very similar gimbal to the Spark, actually, a long time ago, which looked like it was only a two axis, but then they managed to squeeze the third axis in there too. But this gimbal looks totally different. It looks like a miniature Mavic or Mavic Air gimbal as well. So that's only going to be better, I'd imagine, for the stability and stuff like that too, which is really good. And the whole form factor just looks a little bit different too. It looks like the rear legs are kind of tilted up and forward, and, you know, that must be for sort of ultimate efficiency, I suppose. So they've obviously done a lot of testing on this, I should think. And really cool to see how it flies and what it sounds like and stuff.
We were saying, well, I mentioned earlier, it reminds me of actually a bit like the Parrot AI one that got released, that looks buggish. And I think it does. It has almost like a bit of a bug feel to it. Maybe whether it's directly or indirectly, again, it depends on the promotional materials they release. They might come out and be like, yeah, we've taken inspiration from nature, a bit like Parrot did. You know, they might just rip that whole thing off. Who knows?
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel like it has a kind of a bug element.
Yeah, which I think as you keep seeing it and keep looking at the photos, it starts to grow on you. I think it does. To start with, it's a bit of a whoa, what the hell is that? But then you're like,
I think it's the forehead. It's got a very
that's
alien forehead.
Yeah, and to be honest, you know, what does it matter what it looks like? No, you know, as soon as it's in the air, you can't see it really anyway. So, you know, as long as it does the job, I think that's the main thing. And so we've got a few more specs. So maybe two different battery sizes, which is interesting. So obviously the first one will up the flight time a little bit to 34 minutes, which is obviously incredible, really. You know, I keep thinking back to when drones flew for 10 minutes. We were like, wow, that's long. So 34 minutes is ridiculous, really, which is great. But there might be another battery that can actually take it up to 47 minutes, which is almost like a, you know, let's do this just because we can and show off type of thing. But crucially, the caveat there, or the asterisk, I suppose, is that will take it above the 250 grams. So that's kind of obviously going to happen, I think. But it's important for people to know that, because then obviously it takes away its kind of, you know, sort of bonus feature, which is obviously under 250 grams. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that's true and how that'll work, because we were mentioning, Adam, weren't we, before we recorded, that will take it into a different category and all of that type of thing. So there's a bit of a minefield there, isn't there?
Well, that's it, because it sort of, as soon as I realised that, I was like, oh, well, I mean, not to say that it will be a certified drone, just because of kind of what's going on. We might actually end a little bit after this one just talking about the consultation, Mark, just a quick reminder.
Oh, we could do.
But yeah, so if it is over 250 grams with this bigger battery, that means actually it's got a bigger maximum takeoff mass than 250 grams. Therefore, it might be, if it was theoretically a certified drone, it would push it into the C1 category rather than the C0, because its maximum takeoff mass would be up to 900 grams. Well, somewhere between 250 grams and 900 grams,
yeah.
Whereas a C0 needs to have a maximum takeoff mass of 250 grams. So the fact that they've released a new battery that pushes it, the ability, it's got the ability to go into to have a bigger battery and go over that threshold, actually could push it into being a C-1 type aircraft.
Yeah. Do we want it to be certified then? That's the question. Probably not, maybe. I don't know. Weirdly. I can't believe I said that, but yeah.
That's it. Let's keep this one legacy and keep that flying weight under 250 grams.
Yeah. Crucial. That makes sense. That's crucial. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. So I think that's quite a cool thing to sort of see if that develops later on too. And then lastly, a bit of information about the controller. They might have another kind of built-in screened controller, which is always nice to see, with 1000 nit brightness. So I think you can always push the brightness, because we've all been there, we've all been outside in the bright sun and, you know, trying to hunch over your screen to try and see what you're doing. So the brighter the screen, hopefully the more you'll be able to see and the more usable it is as well. There might also be a pro version as well, or like a cine version. You know, there's a lot of information online, obviously, as well. So have a look, but we'll see.
Does the Mini 2 come with a built-in screen? Or is that phone?
No.
So I wonder whether they're going down the pro route. Yes. Yeah. Pro version is get a pro controller with a built-in screen. That's probably where they'll go. There'll be two versions, one with you plug your phone in and it's standard, and then perhaps the other version is, well, actually you get the built-in screen and
that's
their pro version of the aircraft, potentially.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? I think, yeah. So we'll see if that develops as well. But that's pretty much the rumour roundup, I think, for the Mini 3. So, something to look forward to and... I'm going to say put on your Christmas list, but it'll be before then, won't it? So, you know,
it depends on the price.
Just bite yourself.
Price is going to be crucial though, because from looking at some of the leaks,
true, actually,
prices were looking. I think somewhere it was leaked at, was it about 850 euros or something like that? Yeah, maybe so more, they're pushing 900 euros, which puts us in the £750 bracket in the UK. So
it's a bit different, isn't it?
Big jump up again. That could be looking. What that could have been potentially leaked is if there is a pro version, that's with this built-in controller. Fingers crossed, if it's the standard version, it won't be much more than the Mini 2 is now, I would hope.
I would say, you know, £400 is probably what I would be semi-happy to pay for something like that, I should think. If the specs are correct, obviously, but so we'll wait and see for that one as well. Cool, so just before we finish off the episode then and sign off, I think we will just quickly just reiterate the CAA's form and sort of thing that we talked about in the last episode as well. So Adam, maybe just finish off with a bit of information if people haven't heard maybe about that.
Yeah, so there'll be more information if you want to listen to us talk about this properly. It's episode 38.5, so it was a bonus episode that we did a couple of weeks ago by the time this one's been released. So have a proper listen to that. But essentially, I think when this goes out, you've got 1 or 2 days left to have your say on extending the transitional provisions for the open category. So this is where the A2C of C fits into. This is all to do with legacy drones and extending them beyond what is currently the cutoff point of the 31st of December 2022, the end of this year.
Yeah.
So if you want to get them extended, you can have your say. We'll put a link in the description of this, or just Google, you know, CAA consultation, you know, drone consultation.
Yeah. Legacy drone consultation. Yeah.
Something like that. I'm sure you'll find it. It closes on the 13th of May. So like I said, when this goes out, you've got a day, 2 days maybe to get it in, get your opinion. It's a short form. There's like three questions, which are basically yes and no, and then a comment section. Get it in. It's crucial that you have your say, because most people complain they don't have a say about things. Well, this is your chance to have a say.
Yeah, and the more people that have the say, and I imagine we're all going to probably be saying the same sort of thing, then the more chance that they will extend it. And I suppose the big question is, how long will they extend it for? I guess actually is probably the most important one. So I guess we'll see what happens anyway. So there we go. I think that's the end of this episode. So just to sign off then with the usual housekeeping bits and pieces. So again, just like Tony, if you've got a question, send it into dronecast@ uavhub.com. Again, a voice memo is great, but again, if you just want to email, that's also fine too. Subscribe, like I always say. I'm sure you all pretty much are subscribed now, but again, new listeners, if you don't mind subscribing, that would be great too. Review the podcast as well on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and the other places it exists too. That'll help it reach a wider audience as well, which is always nice. And I think that's pretty much everything, isn't it, Adam? Have I covered it all?
I think that's pretty much it.
That's it. Yeah, good. Well, anyway, Adam's off on holiday tomorrow, so he'll already been on holiday. So this is this weird time warped sort of situation we got ourselves into. But I'm sure you will have had a nice holiday, Adam.
I'm hoping I will have had a good holiday.
Yes. There we go. Just to confuse everyone at the end. Anyway, well, thanks for listening, and yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks' time. Fly safe and blue skies. Thanks a lot.